Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome along to another tennis podcast, another week of lockdown in the UK. I hope you're enjoying yourselves. If you're not in the UK and not in lockdown, enjoy that because it's rubbish here. Everything's all the same. Tennis players still trapped in hotel rooms in Melbourne and Adelaide, although they're a little bit less trapped in Adelaide. The tone of their social media posts has somewhat changed since you last heard from us. There's rather more a vibe of we're ever so grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Australia, and Craig Tiley, and to all the health authorities for allowing us to be here and keeping us safe. Thank you very, very much. We've never, ever been ungrateful in our lives. That's the tone of what we're hearing. And it's been a few days since there's been a diplomatic incident in the world of tennis, which is great news because it means we're allowed to solely focus today on Tennis Relived, our first episode of Australian Open Relived, when we'll be talking about Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley, or Yvonne Goolagong as she was known in the early stages of her career. David and Matt are with me. We've had snow this weekend. Sorry, Matt, you're the only place in the country that seemingly didn't have snow. Sorry about that. I don't know what to say other than, as is typical in the UK, when you get one day of snow, the next day the scene is quite depressing. There is a decapitated snowman outside of my window and it's making me feel a bit sad. So as fun as yesterday was, you can feel a bit smug today that there's not a big white sort of battleground type scene outside of your window.
I mean, if ever there was a time for snow, I feel like it is yesterday, when you can't travel anywhere, you don't need to travel anywhere, you can't be inconvenienced by it, and yet we didn't have any at all. We just had a grey, damp, miserable January day. But today the sun is out and the pavements are not slippery, so today I am winning out of the snowy areas, because I know David had an absolute mountain.
David went sledging. Yeah. But failed to understand one of the key principles of sledging, which is that gravity is your friend. You need to find a hill, David, and push your kids down it. You found a particularly labour-intensive way of doing sledging.
Yeah, I dragged them about. it's very flat where we live, so we just went on the field and I just pulled them around for half an hour. And that was my exercise for the week. But we had the best time, just sort of one-upmanshipping everybody with snowmen making until we met our neighbour, who seems to be able to carve some sort of ice sculptures out of the snow and created something that made us all knock ours down.
Yeah. Are you friends with that neighbour? Is it okay if I insult them?
Sounds like you're about to.
I just feel like that's not a cool move.
Oh, come on, everybody was enjoying
when
it.
When everyone's created their really quaint, lovely snowmen, some more impressive than others, to create a sort of 8-foot-tall transformer out of snow is just a big FU, isn't it?
Go and have a look on the community. Our Instagram page if you'd like to see it.
Is this neighbour quite smug?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great.
Especially at the moment.
Do judge books by their covers, folks. That is the lesson I'm teaching you all. Our mascot for this week is Cookie, owned by Shane. Cookie is a 13-year-old Labrador. Cookie will be our mascot throughout this week of Australian Open Relived Pods, and there will be more information about her in our newsletter. So do subscribe to the newsletter for that and a multitude of reasons. Always great content. It's Matt's finest work, or some of his finest work, and I'll be drip feeding him information about Cookie throughout the week. I'm limited to short, sharp bursts because I have the eyes of David Law boring into me. Like, we've talked about dogs for 30 seconds now, Catherine. Time to move on to tennis. So that's your Cookie lot for now. Laura Vergani is our lovely guest editor for this show. And honestly, Laura, your questions and your talking points about Yvonne Goolagong, it's clear that you're a big fan of hers. And they've provided a really great framework for our research and our thinking about this show. So thank you so much for those, and I hope you hear threads of your thoughts throughout the course of the show, which is going to be about, as I said, Yvonne Goolagong, somebody who throughout the course of last year, as we were doing Tennis Relived shows, her name sort of came up tangentially, thinking about talking about, you know, other players, and totally fits into that category of somebody who I probably could have told you roughly how many slams she had won. I think I knew that she had won Wimbledon as a mother. I probably would have said that happened in the late 70s, something like that. I knew she was an Indigenous woman, and that was a significant thing in Australia. But I probably couldn't have told you an awful lot more than that. I certainly don't think, I'm ashamed to say, I'd ever seen a clip of her play, or not one of any length that I can say that I remember.
Yeah, I agree with you. And obviously, I go back further and was alive when she was winning things, but it was before I was really conscious of the sport and understanding of it. And throughout my life and following tennis, covering tennis, I would have seen a match point here or there, or a celebration of hers with the trophy. I knew what she looked like, but I knew nothing about how she played. I knew that she was somebody that people sort of talked about a lot, and I didn't really know why. I didn't really know the story enough. And as you say, when we were doing the Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe stories and various other Tennis Relived editions over the last year, her name kept coming up from listeners who were there, who were alive and following the sport and watching her matches and wanted to hear about her and what she's doing now and just remembering to be nostalgic. And so I think she was, from that, she was always somebody we were interested in looking into. And having done so now, I'm so glad we have, because she's a real discovery for me as somebody a lot more than I expected her to be in terms of the history of the sport.
Matt, as somebody who was very much not at all alive throughout any of Yvonne Goolagong Cawley's career, what was your knowledge coming into this?
Yeah, I'm in a very similar boat to you, Catherine. What I remember most is when we were researching for Wimbledon Relived and we were thinking about what shows we would do for that fortnight, I just randomly asked my mum, who do you most associate with Wimbledon? Who would you want to hear about in shows about Wimbledon? And without hesitation, my mum said, oh, Yvonne Goolagong. I've just told everyone how old my mum is, basically. sorry, mum. But I think it's what David was saying. We've received so many emails as well from listeners, really kind of who lived through that era, professing their love for Goolagong. And I think she strikes me as a player who, if you saw her play, you were really impacted by what you saw, and you were moved by her story. And as you've said, it's been really eye-opening and fascinating to find out that story ourselves.
That tone, that way of talking about her and the way she played is something that's been completely consistent across everybody that we've spoken to for this show. We're going to be hearing from Pat Cash, from Pam Shriver, from Mary Carrillo, of course. But let's start off, by hearing from Billie Jean King, who, when I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago in that interview that I hope you've all listened to, and if you haven't, then please do. But I also asked her what her recollections and thoughts were on Yvonne Goolagong, who she had the opportunity to play many times in her career, and this is what she had to say.
Well, one thing, you never got bored when you're playing Yvonne. She was so beautiful and did unexpected things, which was always kept it interesting. Beautiful back end. Oh my gosh. And she really ran around the court so easily, and she was very balletic. You know, she is, Federer, some of them are just beautiful to watch. And everybody loves Yvonne. I mean, Australia just loves her. I love the way they greet her, the way they embrace her. She is so nice. She always walks in the locker room. Good night, Mike. How are you? It's like so sweet. And she's done so much for tennis too. And she's so kind about it, like having her foundation or helping the indigenous people in Australia now. And she really has given back a lot. And I hope everybody knows that. But she was a great champion. Oh my gosh. She's just a champion on and off the court. I mean, just absolutely fun.
And we will talk lots about everything that Billie Jean picked up on there, the work she's done off the court and the significance of that. We will talk plenty about all of that. But first of all, let's tell you who Yvonne Goolagong was, how she came to be a tennis player, because it is so much more of an extraordinary story than I realized. I mean, some call it sort of the most extraordinary rags to riches stories ever in tennis. I don't think you can definitively say that, not when, you know, we've done shows on Althea Gibson, and for example, but certainly it is right up there. She was born in 1951 in rural New South Wales. She's the third of eight children in an Indigenous family. And theirs was the only Indigenous family in their town. Her father was a sheep shearer, and the family lived in a one-story home, which was a tin shack with dirt floors and no electricity. And I know one of the areas that Laura was keen for us to dig into was what life was like for Indigenous people in Australia at that time. And the answer is, sadly, unsurprisingly, that they faced completely widespread discrimination throughout Yvonne Goolagong's childhood. The Australian government's policy at that time, and this really is extraordinary, and excuse my naivety on this, I'm sure Australians are screaming at their devices, and I hope that this is sort of well known and talked about and reflected upon there, but I had no idea that the Australian government's policy at the time was to forcibly remove Indigenous children from their families and relocate them to camps where they could be properly educated and integrated into white society. And a quote that I found from Yvonne Goolagong on this was, she said, "Every time there was a shiny car, my mum must have worried if it was the welfare people coming for her kids. We had no idea. We thought the welfare man was there to take us away."
The way John Wertheim describes that story is that Yvonne Goolagong and her siblings were not aware of the seriousness of the situation at the time. He talks about it as though it was a game they used to play in their house, because the parent, you know, where they would see a car and everyone would go and hide under the beds and they would make it into a game. But later, obviously, Yvonne Goolagong learned that actually her parents were shielding her from something potentially very, very serious. And I think that's a theme I found, that her parents did try to really shield her. Her Indigenous heritage was not a huge presence in her household while she was growing up. And she talked about how she used to write essays at school where she would sort of talk about the white settlers in Australia as her heroes. And she would talk about the life that they led and how they would shoot Indigenous people. And Yvonne said she didn't think anything of this. That was kind of how indoctrinated it was. And just to paint a bit more of a picture about life for Indigenous people in that time. So Yvonne, as you said, was born in 1951. It wasn't until 1965 that Indigenous people had the right to vote. And it wasn't until 1967 that they were included in the census. And this is still a modern day issue as well. I mean, I'm sure you've been in Australia on Australia Day. And the last two times I've been in Melbourne, I've noticed small protests from Indigenous people who they call it Invasion Day because they say that Australia hasn't reckoned with its past enough and hasn't acknowledged the wars and the massacres that took place. It's something that became more of a feature of Yvonne Goolagong's life later when she really started to engage with her heritage, I think, but it certainly impacted her childhood a lot. And I also Googled the town where she was born, Borellen. And if you go on Google Maps, there's one landmark in the town and it says the big tennis racket. So I clicked on that and it is exactly what it says. It is a huge tennis racket and it's a replica of Yvonne Goolagong's Dunlop wooden racket, 20 times the size of a normal racket. And it's a monument to her. And it's just a sort of permanent reminder that, as you said, one of the most remarkable tennis stories started in that town. They're so proud of her now.
Oh, I love that. I'll pop that on my list of places to visit when I'm allowed to visit anywhere. Her first tennis racket was made from a wood fruit box and it looked like a paddle. It had no strings. And her first tennis dress was made for her from bed sheets by her mum. She'd hit for hours on end against any flat surface she could find. And she was finally able to play tennis on an actual tennis court in Borellen, thanks to a local resident. And he was also the president of the local tennis club, Bill Kurtzman. And he saw her peering through the fence at the local courts and he encouraged her to come in and play. So that's where that all started. And another thing that Laura was interested in is finding out about is whether there were any other Indigenous athletes for that Yvonne Goolagong might have been able to look up to and see as inspiration for her at the time. And I found an article, I found several articles, but 25 greatest Indigenous sports people in Australia. And there were a couple of them that would have predated Yvonne Goolagong, but I could only find one woman, really. That was a cricketer, a real pioneer called Faith Thomas. I found an article from 2016 with her in The Guardian where she says she still thinks she holds the record for being the fastest woman bowler ever. I'm not sure if that's still the case. I'm not sure if we'll ever know because they wouldn't have been able to track speeds in those days. But she was the first Indigenous woman picked for any national sports team when she bowled for Australia in 1958. The first Indigenous woman to represent Australia on the cricket field when she opened the bowling for the Melbourne Test of the 1958 Ashes series. Now, I don't know if she was any kind of inspiration for Yvonne Goolagong. I couldn't find any quotes from Goolagong about Faith Thomas. But, you know, she would have been the only female Indigenous athlete of any note at the time, which is, I suppose, not extraordinary given what we know about that time in Australia's history, but, you know, pretty amazing.
There's something particular about the fact that it was tennis that became a chosen field. We talked about this with Althea Gibson, tennis being this fortress of white men. And obviously, Althea Gibson had broken down those barriers. But then here was Yvonne Goolagong doing similar things. I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but I know on her first visit to Wimbledon in 1970, she was really surprised that there was so much press coverage about her. But obviously, her story was a fascinating one and one worth reporting. And maybe she was a reluctant racial symbol at the time, but she was one. And I think she used to feel a little bit irritated about how the word Aboriginal or Indigenous would always precede her name in these articles. As far as she was concerned, she was just a tennis player who wanted to play. And as you said, there weren't many inspirations for her. She was a real trailblazer, especially in tennis.
Mm, absolutely. And this is probably the sort of it's pointed to as kind of the big moment in her career where her fortunes kind of changed. Word about her talent started to travel. And in 1965, somebody called Vic Edwards, who was the owner of a tennis school in Sydney, he was tipped off about Yvonne Goolagong's talent. And he travelled 400 miles to Barilan to look at Goolagong, who was 14 years old at the time, and he immediately saw her potential. He persuaded Yvonne Goolagong's parents to allow her to move to Sydney to be coached by Edwards. She ended up living in his household. He became her legal guardian, coach, manager. It's documented that he kind of protected her and shielded her, just as her family had, from the racial slurs and the discrimination. He enabled her to compete in big city tournaments and taught her self-belief and made her realise how great her talent was. And at the age of 15, Yvonne Goolagong won the New South Wales Championships. And in 1967, she competed in her first Australian Nationals at the age of 16. So, look, he is a significant figure in Yvonne Goolagong's career. He is a complicated figure. We've tried to do quite a lot of research into him because we'd heard oblique references to him being a complicated figure and kind of aspersions cast on him and his character. There isn't really anything from Yvonne Goolagong herself to suggest that, or certainly to confirm that, which makes it quite difficult to really clarify what kind of a character he was. So we're not going to avoid it altogether. It's just something that it's hard for us to definitively look into. David, I think you found something from Peter Bodo, which is kind of as good and definitive an account perhaps of his character as we might be able to find.
Yeah, I mean, this is from Peter Bodo, who wrote for many, many years for ESPN's website, for Tennis Magazine, a huge figure in the world of the tennis media, and somebody I've known well, and he's just been around for a long time, and he knew Yvonne and her husband Roger Crawley for many, many years, and was friends with them, and he had a brunch with them in 2007, and he references the relationship Yvonne had with Vic Edwards through the prism of her establishing her romantic relationship with Roger Crawley, which would lead to them getting married. And Peter writes that Vic Edwards had obsessively sheltered Yvonne throughout her youth, that he was a talent-worshipping coach who discovered and whisked her away from her home to make her a champion, showed remarkable judgment as well, and it showed remarkable judgment from Yvonne as well, in order to know what she wanted to do when she met Roger, in that they had met secretly in London throughout this time, because they knew that Vic Edwards would not want Yvonne to have any part of this relationship with Roger Crawley. he wanted to wring every drop of potential out of a game, and fooling around with boys would interfere with that, wrote Peter. Roger fought Edwards for Yvonne, and Roger won. Soon after Yvonne accepted his proposal, Edwards gave her an ultimatum: it's him or me. She said she was marrying Roger, no matter the consequences. He didn't blink. She terminated their relationship, and Edwards ultimately went to his grave with his eyes still shut.
Wow. I mean, aside from any of the Vic Edwards stuff, that's a beautiful love story.
Mm. Yeah, it is quite interesting. I mean, obviously, it's fast forwarding a little, but just to see in the 1980 Wimbledon final, to see Roger Cawley in the player box, and to hear the stories, a British guy who just has seemingly been by her side throughout, no matter what, and you know, more than 40 years of being together now, and. Yeah, it does seem to be a lovely story and one where it just conquers all, really. But you're right. When you read the how did she become a tennis player, clearly Vic Edwards was a huge part of that. So it's complicated, and it's you don't know where to stand on it. You can only document the information that is out there, and so that's what we're trying to do.
Mm. Yeah, what I would add on Vic Edwards as well is he was a renowned tennis coach. I think he discovered Bob Hewitt and Fred Stolle, and I think he had a scout who had seen Goolagong and been so swept up by her natural style. I think they were saying that she knew how to get to the ball before she knew how to hit the ball. She just had this sort of natural positioning and natural understanding of the game, and it was that really caught the eye of those talent spotters.
Yeah, I love the idea of kind of Chinese whispers about this young girl's extraordinary ability kind of spreading across New South Wales. Like,
yeah, 400 miles away in Sydney, people know about this special talent.
And we see that on the tennis circuit all the time, don't we? But in these little confined spaces of a Grand Slam, oh, go to court 18 because there's this amazing junior. We like to do it as tennis media and followers and all the rest of it. Fans like to do it. Agents like to do it, but the idea.
And then Matt says, "Oh yeah, I've known about them for 3 years."
But we don't always get it right.
No.
But it is the ultimate, though, isn't it? To think that there is somebody out there, hundreds of miles away, that you know doesn't know she's going to be a tennis player and is talent spotted, and then it happens.
Let's hear from Mary Carrillo, shall we? On that extraordinary Chinese whisper-inducing talent and ability of Yvonne Goolagong.
I think the reason people love Roger Federer is because he makes a hard thing look easy. And, I mean, anybody who can play a musical instrument or create art, or if you're watching a cooking show and some little old Italian lady is sticking meat in pasta and creating tortellini with both hands at the same time, you got my number. And that's what Yvonne looked like out there. I mean, her game did not look taught. It looked like she just knew what to do. And there was not one muscle system in her body that ever railed against another one. She was so smooth and so beautiful to watch. And, I mean, obviously her backstory, her father was a sheep shearer in Borrellin, and her mom, Ash Barty, told great stories. She knows Yvonne well, about how her mom used to make her tennis dresses, you know, and her first racket was a fruit box, and, you know, all that stuff is great. But what I liked most about Yvonne, again, she didn't look like anybody else. She didn't play like anybody else. And I'll tell you, in 1980 at the Avon Championships, I was just there to watch. And I had already seen an awful lot of Tracy Austin and Yvonne Goolagong, and they were playing an indoor carpet court. And it was the last match of the night. And so all the people that Madison Square Garden Network could have interviewed that night, they were all gone. There were no players left. There were no celebrities left. And so it was like a half empty crowd, and Tracy and Yvonne were about to play. And so someone from the Avon PR said, well, go talk to Mary Carrillo, you know, she's, and I just went into this, and I'd had a couple of pops, you know, I'd have been enjoying myself. I mean, I had plenty to say. And I just started talking about why I was hanging around for this match. And that what you got to watch out for in the match was that Tracy was playing a sport and Yvonne was going to play a game. Because that's what it always looked like when I watched Yvonne. She made it look like she was just playing a backyard game. And it was full of imagination and whimsy. And whereas here's Tracy Austin, her game is so taut. It's so efficient. It's so accurate. It's so, you know, she looked like a little Chris Evert. And Yvonne, it looked like she would take back her racket and then decide what to do to the ball at the very last fraction of a moment. And that could mean that she carved under it to hit a backhand slice winner, or she'd hit a lob, or she'd run. So anyway, I was going on and on about why this is going to be a great match. So one of the announcers said to his producer, hey, why don't we have her hang around and call the match? And so they stuck me up in the booth. I didn't even have headsets. They put a microphone in front of me and I just kept going about the stark differences between these two and why it was so great and how Yvonne was such a rhythm player and she can have her off nights too, but not tonight. And Tracy, and I'm going on, and it turned out to be a great match. It turned out to be a 7-6 in the third win for Tracy. And it was just the prettiest thing to see because Tracy, again, we've all seen Tracy play. You knew how she played. You know how she thought. You knew what her patterns were. You knew what she was trying to create out there. And with Yvonne, I mean, it looked like she was just playing to music only she was hearing, you know? That's what I liked about her game so much. And I think that's what captured the fancy of so many people when they watched her play. Anyway, that was the start of my career because some guy heard me that night. And a couple of months later, after a disastrous first round Wimbledon loss, he called me up and said, hey, I heard you at Madison Square Garden. Do you want to do a couple of matches? And that was about 40 years ago. And I'm still on the same sentence.
And if there are any little old Italian ladies with magical fingers where tortellini is concerned, we get in touch. We will supply you with Mary Carrillo's number. One thing I've grown to love over the course of the last week is hearing people come up with turns of phrase to describe the effortlessness of Yvonne Goolagong's playing style. Martina Navratilova read a quote from her saying, Yvonne didn't serve and volley, she sauntered and volleyed. That description from Mary of her playing with whimsy, it made me think of the fact that she became known for the term that was coined for her was going walkabout during matches. And I found a quote from her being asked about her mental walkabouts. And she said, this was her looking back on her career. She said, I just enjoyed life. I like to smell the flowers along the way. And she just wanted it to be fun. And she knew that when it was fun was when she played her best tennis. I love that. And you can see that looking back on clips of her. You can see that in the way she played.
Yeah, I watched the whole of the 1980 final over the weekend that she played against Chris Evert. And, you couldn't get more of a contrast in styles and approaches. It's a bit like what Mary's talking about there with Tracy Austin, this person who plays to these patterns and never gives you a blink of an opportunity. You've got to create them for yourself. And Yvonne Goolagong was able to do that. There were some incredible rallies in that match, and there was one that really sticks in my mind where she throws things forward 35 years to Roger Federer, in as much as she's embroiled in this rally where both players are hitting great strokes, passing shots, volleys, lobs, smashes, and then she suddenly finishes it with this short-angled backhand slice short, which nobody else, I don't think, in the stadium has even thought of as an option to finish the rally. You know, there's no power on it. It's not an out-and-out drop shot. It's just one of those short backhand knifed angled slices that most players just don't even think of. And then, you know, you fast forward 37 years and she's asked about whether she watches tennis, and she goes, I don't watch it much these days. I quite enjoy watching Roger Federer when he played Roddick the other night and hit that backhand passing shot off his toes. I got this feeling, yeah, that must have felt good.
Talk about a connoisseur. She only bothers with Roger Federer.
That's honestly how it comes across, really. And having described earlier how I just wasn't really aware of what she offered, you can see in a single match like that, where she's obviously played really well and she's a little older and has properly grooved her game so that she knows what it is. And as Mary says, she's playing a game. She's not playing sport in that traditional way. You get that feeling that you... Life just feels possible. Everything feels possible when you're watching her play tennis. So throw the shackles off. Don't restrict yourself. Just enjoy it. Imagine being able to go out in a Wimbledon final and think, just enjoy it. That's how it comes across, as if she's playing the sport.
Mm. And I read some quotes that her mother never used to ask whether she'd won or not. She just used to ask whether she'd had fun. And it seems to me like she really carried that attitude into her pro career. And I mean, I just love it when a player's style is what people remember the most. I think there's such an interesting dilemma for coaches of young players, whether you try and sort of impart them with the perfect proper technique or whether you let their natural strokes take hold. And I think, you know, technique is so important. You need reliable technique, and all the best players kind of have this perfect form. But I think it's a good thing that they didn't try and completely alter Yvonne Goolagong and they let her natural strokes take over, because that's the part that people have really become enchanted with, I think. And yeah, it's amazing to watch back the footage and to hear people talk so glowingly about that style.
I think it depends how good your natural style is. Speaking personally, sure. I'm glad I received coaching. So what about her career then and her achievements? Her first major, and note use of major. I've decided to sort of interchangeably sway with the wind on majors and grand slams. Billie Jean, if you're listening, I hope that's acceptable. So she won the French Open in 1971 at the age of 19. It was quite an interesting French Open. Margaret Court, who was the top seed, she suffered a shock early exit. I think Virginia Wade was the second seed, and she went out early as well. And Yvonne Goolagong capitalised. She beat a surprised finalist, another Australian, a woman called Helen Gawley, in a straight sets final. And extraordinarily, that was her only French Open title.
I saw some footage of match point, and she doesn't celebrate. You know, she even...
Oh, Medvedev style.
Yeah, she was doing it way before Medvedev thought of it. She doesn't celebrate. And I think she gave a quote afterwards where she said, you know, kind of what we've been saying, winning or losing isn't the be-all and end-all. She said, I just want the spectators to take home a good memory. And I think everyone left with a good memory because they'd seen her perform so well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So she goes on to Wimbledon, and this is just her second Wimbledon. She made her debut there in 1970, and she had a love affair with Wimbledon. There's quite a well-documented little story that I've seen her tell on a few different chat shows and seen it in print a number of times of her. Well, let's use her own words. She says, "It was the age of nine that I dreamed about winning Wimbledon. I read this cartoon magazine story called Princess in Princess Magazine about a young girl who was found, trained, and taken to this place called Wimbledon, where she played on this magical centre court and eventually won. Every time I went to hit against a wall, I used to pretend I was there. And every time I went to sleep, I would dream about playing on that magical court." And it came true. That dream came true. In 1971, she beat Billie Jean King in the semifinals. She beat Margaret Court, who was the top seed, in the final. And that was an extraordinary upset at the time. Here's a few excerpts from a New York Times write-up about her victory in 1971. It said, "The margin by which she destroyed her 28-year-old Australian opponent defies belief. Of all the reputations that have been shattered here over the past fortnight, this was the most formidable. Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall and Mrs. Billie Jean King have been beaten on occasion, but Mrs. Court, the 1970 Grand Slam winner, the Australian, French, Wimbledon and American titles, was a 2-1 favourite to win today. Yvonne said that she had received a good luck cable before today's match from her parents in the tiny Australian town of Barilan, 365 miles southwest of Sydney. The parents and six of their children watched the match on television. Her father, Ken Goolagong, was quoted in dispatches as saying that when Yvonne won, the kids all ran around the room shouting and leaping. But he said that Yvonne, the third eldest child, will be treated just like all the others when she comes home. Among the 15,000 Wimbledon fans who saw her today were Prime Minister Edward Heath and former Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, who joined Princess Margaret in the Royal Box." That is a collection of people that dates dates it all, rather, isn't it? "Princess Alexandra, President of the All England Club, came down on court and awarded Miss Goolagong the silver platter. Her victory was worth $4,300. And her plan tonight was typical of a teenager who takes the pressures of championship tennis in her stride. She said, I guess a group of us will go to a disco tonight to celebrate. She said, come to think of it, I was going to celebrate anyway." Alf Chafe, an Australian newsman who's been staying with Edwards, with that's Vic Edwards and his wife, said Yvonne, quote, "hasn't got a nerve in her body. She showed me her gown for Saturday's Wimbledon ball last night, and then I knew it was curtains for Margaret." So she had her ball gown before she'd won. That's a really baller move, isn't it?
It's as baller as it gets.
I love that. This sort of completely understated total self-confidence and self-belief. Really cool. Love that story. So that was her second Grand Slam title. Her first Wimbledon title. She reached three further Wimbledon finals in the 1970s, and she would win another Wimbledon, and we will come on to talk about that. But first of all, let's talk about her experiences at the Australian Open, her home Grand Slam, which she won four times and three times consecutively between 1974 and 1976. And all the write-ups I've read of that first victory in 1974 suggested it was a long time coming. It felt like when Andy Murray won Wimbledon in 2013, felt like there'd been years of people saying, when's she going to win this thing? She'd lost in three previous finals by that stage, and she beat Chris Evert finally in the 74 final. It was played in oppressive heat and humidity. This was from a write-up on the Australian Open website. And she actually took a shower between the second and third sets. And when she returned to court for the third set, she was wearing what became her trademark wet handkerchief tied around her neck to keep her cool. I love that. That is a technique I'll be trying in the future.
In the snow?
Yeah. I mean, in in the summer to come. So then she comes back in 1975 to defend her Australian Open title for the first month for the first time. Now, just a few months prior to that, less than that even, I think just a few weeks, her father Ken was killed in a car accident in Sydney. She still defended her title. She beat Martina Navratilova in the final, but she was seen weeping on Vic Edwards' shoulder during the presentation ceremony. I mean, just extraordinary to think that that she was able to do that. I mean, by all accounts, she was in the States at a tournament in Houston when her father died. And it was just this tremendous shock. He was only 44 years old. It happened all of a sudden. And Yvonne out of the country. So extraordinary that she defended that title. And then she coasted to the title again in 1976. And then in 1977, there were two Australian Opens. There was one in January, which she skipped because she was pregnant with her daughter, Kelly. But then she returned for the December edition and claimed her fourth and final title. And by doing that, she became the first mother in the Open era to win a Grand Slam title. So technically, she won four in a row of ones she's played. And in terms of the dates, it looks like four consecutively. But obviously, the history books around that time with the Australian Open are a bit quirky.
And that second Australian Open in 1977, there's this weird story about what the umpire had to do during the match because of the way the scoreboards were done in those days. The women took their husband's name. Yvonne was married to Roger Corley, and Helen Gourlay, her opponent in that final, was married to Richard Corley. So they were both Mrs. R. Corley on the scoreboard. So the umpire just got confused during the match, gave up, and started calling them Yvonne and Helen.
What a good idea!
I've got a really simple solution to that problem.
Yep.
Yeah. And actually, it is watching that 1980 Wimbledon final. It is so jarring to me to see Mrs. J. Lloyd, as Chris Evert was referred to, against Mrs. R. Corley. It really dates it to me, at least. I thought nothing of it when I was a kid, but yeah, it really dates it. By the way, the thing that when we talk about what did I know about Yvonne Goolagong, what I really, really was taken aback by was just how consistent she was, how relevant she was for so many years.
Consistency isn't sexy, David.
And yet she effectively had it all, because she had the whimsy and the skill, the racket ability, and
that made it sexy,
and was supposed to be able to just turn up and just play this game. And yet she's got this list of honors, okay, a lot of near misses as well, but she was a relevant force for a decade. I wasn't expecting to find that when we decided to do the show.
And I think Laura pointed out to us that she reached more Grand Slam singles finals in the 70s than any other player, male or female. And when you think of the 70s, you think a golden era of tennis, an incredible decade, so many great players. And Yvonne Goolagong was the one who reached the most major finals.
She reached three Wimbledon finals in the 70s after winning the title in 71, and she had to wait till 1980 for her second Wimbledon title. It would be her last Grand Slam title, and it is still the only triumph for a mother at the All England Club in the Open era. She had a three-year-old daughter, Kelly, with her husband, Roger. She beat Chris Evert in the final. And she said that that second title was actually more special than the first. This quote from a piece from the WTA website. She said, "My dream growing up was to win Wimbledon, which was fantastic when it happened in 1971. However, I loved playing after having Kelly. She made our lives complete and even more full of joy. In 1980, I had to overcome 2 years of injuries and illness. I really wanted to win Wimbledon again. I later wrote in my book that underneath the torrent of emotion I felt after winning was a deep and abiding happiness, the kind of happiness that comes when you know that you have truly, sincerely given your best and your best has been the best," which is wonderful. I mean, slightly depressing to know that I'll probably never experience that feeling, but it sounds great.
In your own sphere. There were a couple of lovely, wonderful account, I agree, and a couple of lovely commentary lines from that 1980 Wimbledon final. One from the BBC radio commentator Max Robertson at the time. On Match Point, he explodes with, "And in Borellen, you can throw your hats over the moon down under." And Dan Maskell, who was the long-time BBC television commentator, and I think this really puts it into perspective, he said, "She is one of the most popular players we've ever had at Wimbledon." And if you consider the decades that he'd seen by then, and all the players that they'd come across, and yet she stood out for so many, I think, back then. And yeah, it really comes through in all the accounts that we've got on this show as well, I think.
I think it was at that tournament that she was dubbed the Sunshine Supergirl by Bud Collins.
Yeah,
And that's a nickname that's really stuck. Pam Shriver played that Wimbledon in 1980, and she remembers it well.
For me, the tournament I remember the most was my third Wimbledon, 1980, when after she had had like Achilles tendon major issues, and she'd already had the primary part of her career in the 70s, she won Wimbledon as a mom. And it hadn't been done. Margaret Court had done it, and it wasn't that unusual in 1980. But it was still, given her injuries, given she'd had a baby, and that was an amazing win. And it was quite a few years after she had won her first major. And the other thing I think about having played her was just how it looked effortless. She just flowed around the court. She had a grace and a style, the slice backhand, the chip backhand, just how she moved around the court was as calm looking as any athlete. And I know for people who were great fans of hers, which were many of us, you could be infuriated that she could lose focus or whatever, but whatever. That was a part of the beauty of Yvonne Goolagong. And I think she's underrated as far as tennis greats, tennis champions who go on to do great things in their life and to improve the lives of others. What she's done for Indigenous Australians for over decades and decades is really unbelievable. To me, it ranks right up there with like the stature of Arthur Ashe, and in a different way. I mean, Billie Jean King is much more of a in-your-face U.S. kind of promoter, and she'll wave the flag. Whereas Yvonne is much more shy. But what Yvonne's been able to do, I think, is unbelievable, and I give her so much credit. And Roger, her husband,'s been right there as a partner. So she's helped so many lives. I admire it.
When she won that Wimbledon as a mother, do you remember what the response to it was like? What the reception behind the scenes in the media? Because obviously, I've got the benchmark of how we talk about Serena now, who's aiming to achieve back. What was it like back then?
Well, it was as popular a win. I compare it a little bit to more of a modern day when Kim Clijsters won as a mom in 2009 at the U.S. Open. And say when Kim Clijsters won her first major after coming short, and she's such a popular player. Yvonne Goolagong, she was popular in every corner of the locker room, in every country she played in. So honestly, I can remember at Wimbledon when I would be outside center court, if she was playing on center court and not against Virginia Wade or Sue Barker, but if she was playing against anyone else from another country besides Great Britain, you thought that Yvonne was from Great Britain. She was that popular. She was almost like a version of her era, like Roger Federer is popular universally. That's how Yvonne Goolagong was seen. It's just, you never heard anybody say anything bad about Yvonne. She was just lovely as a player, as a spokesperson, as a family person, and somebody who gives back to tennis and to her community.
Yeah, and that is something we should talk about, her post-retirement career and her contributions to tennis and to her Indigenous community, because it's so substantial. She retired in 1983. She was 32 years of age, and the injuries were kind of accumulating for her at this point. She had won 92 professional titles, including 7 majors at the time she retired. She moved to South Carolina in the States for a while, and she became the touring professional at the Hilton Head Racquet Club. Can you imagine that now, a 7-time Grand Slam champion becoming a touring pro at a local tennis club? Amazing.
By the way, there was a lovely line, wasn't there, from Mary talking about how she went to a clinic with her playing doubles and so forth, and whilst she was a great presence in the group, but at the same time it came so naturally to Yvonne that when she was asked to sort of explain to everybody what to do, she was like, well, you just sort of do it.
There was a line from Mary where she went, what, you mean tactics? This sort of really foreign concept is amazing. So she eventually did move back to Australia, to Noosa, which, why wouldn't you? For anyone that's been to Noosa, if you had the opportunity to live there, you would take it.
What's it like? I haven't been.
It is utopian. Oh. I learned to surf in Noosa.
Oh, did you?
Because they have shark nets.
Right. I had to go surfing in Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't go very well.
Is there video of that, David?
No.
You've got quite a high centre of gravity, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Although so does my brother, and he is a very good surfer, so it's achievable, David.
You've seen the respective athletic coordination of your brother and myself, right?
I'm just saying, if we've learned anything from Yvonne Goolagong, it's, dream big.
Okay.
Just to say, the reason she went back to Australia was for her mother's funeral. Her mother died, I think, in 1991, and she went back for the funeral, and she said it was kind of like an epiphany for her. She suddenly realized that she had all this family and all this heritage that she'd never properly engaged with. And then it sort of started this new phase of her life where she really put all her energy and her focus into finding out about her own background. I think she wrote her autobiography quite soon after she returned, and then she's done all this incredible, incredible charity work for Indigenous people in Australia ever since.
Mm, she started working with Tennis Australia. She launched the Yvonne Goolagong Getting Started program for young girls. And since 2005, she's run the Goolagong National Development Camp, which is for Indigenous girls and boys, which uses tennis as a vehicle to promote better health, education and employment. And she talks about how, and this is really reminiscent of Billie Jean King when I read these quotes, she talks about how the camps they're not just to promote the chances of Indigenous youngsters to play the game. I mean, they are, absolutely, but it's also to help them to become coaches and administrators to increase representation of Indigenous people throughout the sport. We've talked a lot, and Billie Jean King, sort of the ultimate authority, has talked a lot about the significance of that. In 2007, this is an extraordinary story, really. She was retrospectively awarded a world number one ranking for a 2-week period in 1976. Parts of this were from a write-up by the Australian journalist Linda Pierce. She said the belated accolade followed a search of the WTA rankings archive in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is where the WTA is based, which discovered that several paper records were missing between April and July of 1976, and most notably the period from April 26. The rankings are now issued weekly, but they used to be calculated fortnightly. That was right up until 1990. And it says it transpired that Goolagon Cawley overtook Chris Evert by 0.8 of a ranking point after the Australian's victory in the Virginia Slims Championships held in Los Angeles in late April, before Evert regained the crown on May the 10th. And speaking at the time, in 2007, when she was awarded officially the world number one ranking, Yvonne Goolagong said the following. She said, "I was asked the other day what other times in my life I have felt this great, felt this proud. And I think it was walking over the Sydney Harbour Bridge in 2000 for Aboriginal Reconciliation. I was very proud, not just for myself, but for all Australians, because there were thousands of people and I was just overwhelmed by it all. So this is up there."
Yeah, it's a lovely story, isn't it? I think John Dolan, who now works for the LTA, was responsible partly for finding out that information in the rankings archive, you know, and
she thanked John for his detective work.
Hey, well done, John. But you know, it is one of those. Like I say, there's another one that I just feel. I know you asked at some point to Mary, do you feel that Yvonne Goolagong was underrated to some degree? And she said, well, not by me, but I feel like a little bit of it has been lost in time. A little bit of it is of her impact on the actual sport and her success is forgotten in a way that, again, I'm just glad that we've at least educated ourselves about it, because she did so much more than I realized.
I was thinking that even that 1980 Wimbledon win was then overshadowed almost, because the next day you've got Borg McEnroe. And of course, that is an incredible match, which quite rightly lives in everyone's memory and everyone's very aware of that match. But I think it goes somewhat to the disservice that tennis does women by scheduling them on the Saturday and the men's final on the Sunday, that occasionally those incredible women's finals, which were every bit as magical and special as the men's finals, sort of inevitably, or maybe not inevitably because you can do something about it, but often get a little bit forgotten. You know, I was reading some of the write-ups of that 1980 Wimbledon, and Yvonne winning as a mother is buried because this incredible match took place the next day. So yeah, I certainly think she was appreciated and remembered, but there's parts of her career, as you said, that probably have been a little bit lost in time.
I certainly feel, you know, given her achievements and the significance of her as a figure, I don't feel that she's perhaps talked about and recognised as much as she should be. I'm interested in whether that's the case in Australia, particularly now when they are, I mean, as Matt was saying, in a lot of people's views, not as much as they should be, but they do seem to be starting to reckon with their past concerning the Indigenous population. Let's hear from Pat Cash on that, on his recollections of Yvonne Goolagong as a young male tennis player coming through the Australian ranks.
As a kid, you know, sneaking into Kooyong, very, very vivid. Watching Yvonne, two of the people that I watched quite a lot of when I was a young player coming through, and my coach would ask me to come and watch these players, because I was smaller. You know, I couldn't hit the ball like Newcomb and those guys, but I could hit the ball closer to the way the women played as a 16 year old. And he said, "You watch Margaret Court and Yvonne's backhand, and they both had the most elegant, beautiful backhands." And so I used to sit there and watch them forever. But Yvonne, the way she moved was phenomenal. Margaret was a very powerful, incredible athlete. You know, she is a modern day athlete, you know, strong, went to the gym, did all that sort of stuff, and was super fit. Yvonne was a complete natural, shall we say. Not to say that she was better than or worse than Margaret, but she floated around the court and very elegant. Beautiful backhand. Her forehand was flat, but her volleys, the way she could move around the net, and her serve was very, very precise, particularly on a grass court. It was almost like poetry in motion when you watched her play, and you couldn't help but marvel at her balance, her focus, and she's just so charming. I mean, she's a very pretty woman, and as a schoolboy, you just sort of sit there and like, well, look at this. This is an angel dancing around the tennis court.
she seemed very popular. Is that how it seemed to you? As somebody, you know, I mean, you've had your ups and downs with the media and you know, you had good times and bad times. She didn't seem, at least from where I'm standing, nobody ever seemed to have any. Ever get into any run-ins with her? She seemed to be incredibly popular.
Very, very popular. And here's the first Indigenous woman who made it overseas. I mean, she's a massive hero for the Indigenous population, who were and still are, in many ways, regarded as second-class citizens in Australia. And she was a hero. I'm not sure if, what everybody thought of her at that time. I certainly had my opinion, as we've spoken about. But she really bridged a very painful situation in Australia between when it comes to Indigenous rights. It is an understatement. I mean, there's one thing watching some football players. We have Aussie rules football players or rugby players who are Indigenous, and they were superstars. And you could say, wow, look at these guys. But she was our princess, a golden girl that went overseas and won Wimbledon and was an international superstar, and who was Indigenous, who was black. And she's done more good in that department for relations. She continues to do so. I mean, her charity work is absolutely phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal what she's done. And she's absolutely a hero. I don't know anybody who says has ever said anything bad about her. She's a role model for black, for white, for every Australian.
Gosh, find someone that talks about you the way Pat Cash talks about Yvonne Goolagong.
Yeah.
That was just wonderful, wasn't it? And it kind of brings us on to the final talking point with regards to Yvonne Goolagong's legacy, I suppose, which encompasses all the work she's done for the Indigenous population in Australia. And I know this is a completely impossible question, and it's one I put to Mary with the preface that it's a completely impossible hypothetical question. But without Yvonne Goolagong, would there be an Ash Barty? And Mary reminded us of the story of her post-win press conference, Ash Barty's, at the French Open in 2019, when all the questions were about Margaret Court and what an idol she must have been and following in her footsteps. And Ash Barty very quietly but very firmly put the media in their place and said, Yvonne was my hero, Yvonne was my idol and my inspiration.
Yeah, it says everything, doesn't it, really? And the straightforwardness with which she said that as well. She was categoric, emphatic. And there's a lovely video that Wimbledon put together about Yvonne Goolagong, which is narrated by Ash Barty. And you can feel the affection and respect that she had and still has for her. And they remain good friends, I believe. There's the lovely story that you made me aware of, Catherine, in your reading about the time out of the sport that Barty had when she was struggling, when she was coming along as a teenager, and she was all a bit too much for her, and the first person that got in touch with her was Yvonne, wasn't it?
Yeah, Barty's dad, Rob, said, when Ash decided to give tennis away for the first time, which is a lovely turn of phrase in itself. Said when she decided to give tennis away for the first time because she'd had enough and we never thought she'd go back, the first text message she got from anyone was from Yvonne. And Yvonne said to her, good decision, doll. Go and wet a line and catch a few fish. And since then, they've been in touch all the time, which I love. You know, it's so perfect, isn't it? As we've talked about Yvonne Goolagong, somebody who at the heart of her tennis was enjoyment and being in love with the sport and playing the sport, she got it from Ash Barty, and that's so powerful. And there are so many nice quotes from Barty talking about Goolagong. She said, "Deep down, we are friends, but most importantly, we are family. That is something not many people can say, and we share that really special heritage, which is probably the most special thing about our relationship. When I first met Yvonne, I was gobsmacked. She's this incredible lady who had a remarkable career. And for us, our culture and our heritage, it is really special to know that she has paved the way for so many people. When I was a bit older, I began to understand how much of an impact she truly had, how much time and energy she's invested into creating opportunities for all Indigenous youth across the nation." And just to kind of complete the circle, the love-in circle of the Bartys and the Goolagongs, this is Yvonne Goolagong talking about Ash Barty. She said, "I didn't watch tennis during the early days of my retirement from the sport at all. And then Roger Federer came along and I thought, oh, look at those skills." Great quote. "But I wish there was a girl or a woman who could come along and learn all those skills too and be able to base their game on Federer. And then along came Ash and I thought, fantastic."
Just sums it up perfectly, doesn't it? And
I love the idea of her at home just only tuning in when Roger Federer or Ash Barty's playing in disarray, going, "Nah, you're all right."
yeah, it's I'm pretty sure that's how it is. That
discerning
works for me.
Discerning is how I'd describe that. I'm all for people being discerning. It's lovely, isn't it? And look, we'll never know if there would have been an Ash Barty if there wasn't an Yvonne Goolagong, but it certainly would have been a lot harder for her. And I love how much of an awareness and an appreciation Ash Barty has of that. It's really, we talk a lot about Ash Barty being this down-to-earth person with great perspective and everything, but it's really shown up by that relationship she has with Yvonne Goolagong and how desperate she is to talk about her all the time and force her to the forefronts of people's minds as much as she can.
Mm. Yeah, she gets it. And in keeping, I feel, with our decision and discovery of the importance of the past above and beyond certainly what I would have given it in the past myself. Yeah, I really appreciate that about Barty, because not everybody can be bothered, and she clearly can be. So good for her.
Mm.
I feel like Ash Barty doing what she's doing is a perfect example of what progress is, following on from Yvonne Goolagong. And as she said, she's humbled, she's honoured to walk in her footsteps, and yeah, and just on the Australian Open and on Yvonne Goolagong, do you remember last year Martina Navratilova and John McEnroe went on to court with a banner saying,
another of tennis's diplomatic incidents.
Yeah, saying that they think it's time to rename the Margaret Court Arena the Yvonne Goolagong Arena.
Mm. It was a beautiful banner as well.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, Margaret Court's being honoured this year, isn't she? Her name is everywhere. She's been given a something, a merit. She's been given something. Anyway, this is not the Margaret Court podcast. This is the Tennis Relived Yvonne Goolagong podcast, and it's been an absolute pleasure to learn more about her. It really has. We're going to be doing 4 Australian Open Relived podcasts throughout this week. Tomorrow, David, we're encroaching on your era,
yeah,
aren't we?
I'm creeping back in time into the 80s to just sort of expand my compass of understanding. And
when we were divvying up the research, David said, "Yep, I'll do that one."
Yep.
And then Pete Sampras and 1995 was mentioned. Yes. David's like, I've already started on the research for that.
Yeah, so I'll just carry on with that. But yeah, we're going back into 1988 and the first staging of the Australian Open at Melbourne Park, what was then known as Flinders Park, the move from Kooyong, the storylines either side of that in 87 and 88, hearing from Pat Cash, who just has such a wonderfully vivid memory of that time and his huge part in it as somebody who was in the men's singles finals of both of them. So we just want to tell the story of how the Australian Open moved, what it was like before, what it was like after, and the many, many storylines that were part of that couple of years.
Mm. So that's tomorrow, Thursday. We're taking you back to the 90s and to a huge moment in Pete Sampras's career and in the viewing public's perception of Pete Sampras. And then on Friday, we're going back to 2017, folks.
When Matt was alive.
When Matt... Well, yes, more than alive.
More than alive. I've never felt more alive than during those 2 weeks.
That's why we're doing it.
Yeah. I was rooting through my phone yesterday for pictures of 2017 and, oh, yeah, take me back. But that's for later in the week. We're gonna sleep tight tonight with thoughts of Yvonne Goolagong's poetic tennis. So thank you for listening to this. Thank you for our contributors to that show. As always, it wouldn't be the same without you. We have shout outs, Matt, I think.
Yes, we do. For Kate Summerfield, who I think is very probably related to Ruth Summerfield, who we had last time.
Oh.
All right, Kate.
Hello, Kate. Quite like Kate Somerville, which is a really nice brand of skincare.
We're really scraping the barrel of links now, aren't we?
Well, I could list famous Kates, but... Winslet? Middleton?
Who's next,
Matt? Next, Matt, next.
Next is Alison Copley.
Oh, hello, Alison.
All right, Alison. My sister's called Alison. Yeah. Aww. She's lovely as well. So thanks ever so much for your support.
And finally, David Smith of Only Connect fame.
Oh, we know David,
oh,
don't we?
Come on.
He came to our live show.
He did.
He's a lovely fella.
What a thing to have after your name, of Only Connect fame.
Mm.
Why is he of that fame?
He was on Only Connect.
Was he?
2 years ago, maybe.
How did he perform?
I think pretty well. I think his team name was the Dark Siders, which I'm guessing means they're either Pink Floyd fans or Star Wars fans. I think Pink Floyd. But David, if you're listening, please do correct us. And actually, yeah, it's Monday. Only Connect's on tonight. Great news.
Never seen it.
If you want to feel bad about your intellect, Only Connect is the show for you.
Yeah, but so somehow it manages to make you feel good at the same time.
Yeah, because you get one.
If you
and
get
you
one, you're like, you're
yeah,
genius.
Yeah, you feel like, all right, I'm in Mensa then. Yeah.
No surprise that I've never seen it.
But yes, endless admiration for David Smith for appearing on the show. So thank you, David. Thank you to Chris Albert Lee, our executive producer, to Zeus, to Rogue, to Scousel Mousel, to Cookie, more about Cookie later in the week, to Pat Cash, Pam Shriver, Mary Carrillo and Billie Jean King. I'll never tire of saying those words. Thank you for your contributions and we'll see you tomorrow for the 80s.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.